Morning, Council. Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. We are here on behalf of Julie Bailey, who was convicted of murder by abuse or neglect in the Superior Court. There are two issues raised on appeal. I'd like to address the first issue. I won't address the facts in any detail. I don't intend to address the facts in any detail in the case because there's limited time, and I know the court is already familiar with those facts. Insofar as the corpus delicti issue, at its core, this is a disappearance case. In that sense, it's distinguishable from several of the prior cases that the court has considered insofar as corpus delicti. In that sense, also, it harks back to some of the original cases under the common law which generated the corpus delicti rule. Persons who disappeared and based upon circumstantial evidence and statements, other persons were arrested and charged with their homicide. They were convicted. In Perry's case, back in the 17th century, he was actually executed, and the victim of the alleged victim of the murder appeared about a year or two later in the precinct alive. That generated the corpus delicti rule. So that is why this case is distinguishable from some of the prior cases of the court. Nelson, in fact, there was a body. There was evidence that the death had been accomplished by criminal means. Shipley, same thing. Not a disappearance case. There was substantial evidence that the death had been accomplished by criminal means.
The defense in that case was he could walk in the courtroom at any time.
That is because the claim was that the identity was not the victim. You know, I concede that, but there was a death that was established and criminal means, and it's distinguishable for that reason.
Well, is there any dispute here that the baby was left on the step of the father's?
Not based on the record, Your Honor. Not based on the record. The corpus delicti rule, the court has summarized it as such in Delaware. There must be some evidence.
Well, can I follow up on that?
Yes.
Just so I'm clear? So it was not argued at trial that because they canvassed the neighborhood, because the occupants of that residence did not retrieve the baby, that this story about leaving the baby there was made up and that something much more foul play happened to the infant.
That was argued at trial.
That was
argued at trial. Yes, that was.
So that could have been a finding of the jury based on the verdict.
There were inferences to that, but that is similar to the disappearance cases in that there was evidence of a person who existed, who disappeared, who went to a location, went to the woods, was seen with someone going to the woods, and never seen again.
What was the point of the exchange in the record involving the person that was with the mother the night of the birth? As I understand it, that person said the child cried, then the baby was wrapped up in a bath mat, and then there was no crying in the car. And then there was some suggestion that the baby's face had been covered, and then the judge regrouped and said the baby's face wasn't covered. One way to look at this whole exchange was a suggestion that the witness was implying the baby was dead in the car. And then the judge saying, well, the face wasn't covered, seemed to suggest that perhaps the baby really was alive if it was left on the step. But can you clarify that part of the record?
Well, that's the implication from the record, and that's the implication the state was trying to leave the jury with. However, that in and of itself, we contend, is insufficient as a matter of law to prove beyond reasonable doubt that a homicide occurred at that point. It's simply insufficient. That's why the state went on and argued further circumstances, that the child was left on a doorstep in the cold, et cetera. And in a sense, the state tried to close every door, possibly, but by the same token, the homicide by criminal, there is insufficient evidence of homicide by criminal means. the some evidence independent of the confession.
But was there any basis in the record for the jury to conclude the child was already dead in the car?
We do not believe so based on that evidence. It would be, you know, besides the corpus delicti question, that would be insufficient under Jackson versus Virginia as a matter of law to find a homicide beyond reasonable doubt at that point, because babies do quiet occasionally. And it just doesn't remove it from the realm of reason.
The doctor who testified, the expert witness, said when you have, however he described the crying sounds, you have a baby in distress, and then if the baby becomes quiet, you know, that's an indication that perhaps the child has died.
It's perhaps an indication. It's that it isn't proof to a reasonable degree of medical certainty. It's certainly not proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, with regard to your second issue, based on your experience, has that instruction ever been given in any other case that you know of?
No, I do not believe it has, Your Honor. I've never encountered it. I think the prosecution perhaps was prepared for it. Defense counsel was certainly not. I just point out that in many instances on appeal, counsel for the appellant is left with a situation of arguing on behalf of a legal point that was not objected to at trial, or there was a tepid objection. In this case, this objection was one of the more vigorous one can ever expect, and we submit that there was a reason for it.
The judge said it was relevant to show state of mind of the defendant, is that right?
Yes.
Was there any limiting instruction given to that effect?
No, I do not believe so, no.
Was there any evidence to connect the defendant to show that she had knowledge of this statute?
No, there was not.
Well, what was the point in the record where, or how did it get into the record that she thought the people at the hospital would have known her?
That was in the record. I believe that there was a statement given to a police officer to that effect, one of the investigating detectives. I believe that Ms. Bailey also mentioned that on the stand.
Well, and the mens rea here was reckless conduct, right?
Correct.
Would it not go toward the extent to which she or anyone's presumed to have knowledge of the statute, that given her unique background as a nurse, having worked at the hospital, that a failure to follow that act would suggest that leaving the baby on the step had to be reckless under those circumstances?
Well, in that sense, I guess it was part of the state's theory that it was recklessness per se. Since because of that, but there's no showings as that she was aware of it. In addition, it sets a statutory bar of recklessness per se where there is none. Now,
it wouldn't necessarily have to be recklessness per se. If the inference is she worked at the hospital, mm-hmm. and this was a law that's uniquely tailored to hospital care mm-hmm. or health care, mm-hmm. and that health care professionals would ordinarily know of the responsibilities mm-hmm. generally or obligations of, mm-hmm. of a hospital, isn't the inference that even more than those of us ordinary citizens who are presumed to know the law, that she would have been aware that she had an alternative, and failure to opt for that alternative would be reckless?
That's an inference without support in the record. There was no...
She's a nurse.
That's all. There are nurses who aren't familiar, says, with the law. There, says, are doctors. Not everybody. She wasn't a nurse, first of all. She wasn't an RN.
A common law saw that we're all presumed to know the law?
Well, we're all presumed to know the law if it's relevant, says, to the case. But this was not relevant.
I thought Title 11 addressed the whether there were any more presumptions in the criminal law.
In a sense, this set up a presumption, but there can't be a presumption under these circumstances. Inferences are permissible, says, but not presumptions. The presumption to know the law, yes, but the law is not. This is not a situation where there are two factors.
Let me be direct on that. Do you concede today that as a matter of law, there is a presumption that a criminal defendant knows the law and that the jury can infer that or can be charged on that presumption?
Yes, if the offense is a malum in se type offense, and if it's not, it's a strict liability question because it is not this malum in se. Under those circumstances, one is presumed to know the law.
Under a conclusive presumption?
No, not in that sense. If it's not, it's a malum in se, it's offense. There's one point I'd like to make here, which I think is very important, and that's the timing of how this happened also.
Not the crime, but
how no, the timing. The timing of this instruction. There was no cross-examination of the defendant concerning this. There was no testimony, says, that made it relevant. Conceivably, had she said on the stand that, well, I thought of bringing the baby to the hospital emergency room and leading the child there, says, and running out, but I was afraid if I did that, I might get caught and I'd be charged with neglect of a child, which is a criminal offense. Under those circumstances, a prosecutor could say, well, ma'am, just, you're a nurse. Aren't you aware of the Safe Arms for Babies Act?
I thought you said she was not a nurse.
I think she's a practical nurse, if I'm not mistaken, so I shouldn't be loose with the words. Or a nursing assistant. A nursing assistant, yes.
So as I understand it, the defense was that she took the baby to the house where she thought the father was residing, and she knocked on the door, rang the bell, thought there was movement in the house, and according to her, felt comfortable leaving the baby there. So consequently, that was her first choice, and the idea of going to the hospital was not relevant to anything in the case.
Correct. If there had been testimony to the effect that she was afraid of being charged with neglect if she left the baby at the hospital and there was follow-up cross-examination, which made that a pertinent issue, perhaps subject to impeachment, then conceivably it would have been relevant. But it was not relevant under these circumstances. It was as if someone, let's say, for passing where state of mind is critical. Someone is charged with passing counterfeit currency, and their defense is that I didn't know it was counterfeit when I went to the bank teller. I didn't really pay much attention to it. It was just one bill out of 20 that I was submitting. And the jury is given instruction that, well, ladies and gentlemen, says, I'm not passing judgment on the defendant's guilt, but there are legal ways to make a living. Counsel used the example of robbery, and that's the critical part of this is that the instruction itself was irrelevant. And it was a sort of a tipping instruction. It's almost like at that point when that instruction was given, it's checkmate.
Well, wasn't it all over when the police officer read it from the stand anyway?
Yeah. Yes.
Do you quarrel with the procedure of having a police officer read the law to the jury from the stand?
Yes, I do.
Did that in some way prejudice your client, in your view?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Whether or not that should have been done, was there any prejudice to your client as a result of it having happened?
Yes, because the court was perceived by virtue of the way that the court gave the instruction to the jury that this is the law, and had the police officer read it, in a sense it made the police officer a representative of the court rather than an objective independent witness. That was another problem with it. In addition, it was a factual instruction under these circumstances.
Was there any evidence presented by the prosecution or anyone else about training of potential nurses such as your client in this law, or anything at all in the evidence to show that she would have knowledge of it?
No, there was not, Your Honor, and that again just shows the aggravating nature, says, of this error. Where it came. It came at the end of the evidence.
Well, let's assume for a moment that it never happened. The police officer didn't announce the law to the jury from the stand under oath. the judge didn't charge on the Safe Babies Act on the theory that it went to the mens rea of the defendant and provided a basis for them to conclude that her conduct was reckless. Let's just assume what the jury heard was her theory of the case, that she left the baby, as we've described, ad nauseum. Given the weather conditions, given the circumstances that no one came to the door to take the baby immediately and that she didn't wait until someone did, why isn't that recklessness or reckless conduct?
Well, it's not reckless conduct is because the jury must be able to find that free of error in the instructions. And we can't remove that from the equation. If there's not a corpus delicti problem, it perhaps could be sufficient. But the problem is the instruction, since we just can't obliterate it at this point. It's there. It influenced the jury. We can't presume that juries probably disregard most of what a judge says, so we can assume that they didn't pay much attention to this. This came right at the end of all of the evidence after the defendant herself had testified. It was almost a checkmate instruction.
Do you agree there was no further instruction in the final instructions to the jury on it? You don't agree?
I do not recall, Your Honor. I do not recall.
The transcript's not here, but at least the judge's marked up copy of the charge is, and I did not see it.
All I can say is if that issue had been addressed again in the closing instructions, unless it was a blunder of oversight, I would have included it, whether it was adverse or not.
Did you want to save your last 3 minutes?
Yes, sir, I would like to, if permitted.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. May it please the Court. I'll address the two issues in the order that they are presented in the briefing and the argument today. On the corpus delicti issue, the starting point really is whether or not this was a confession. The trial judge, for purposes of ruling on this challenge by the defense that the state had not established the corpus delicti, did assume that the various statements that the accused made, Julie Bailey, did constitute a confession. However, I'm not sure that when you look at the statements individually, that apart from her admissions that she actually left the child on the doorstep, that some of the other statements are truly confessional in nature. She does categorically deny when she takes the stand in the defense case killing her son. So I think the initial question the court has to resolve is whether or not these statements or some of these statements are actually confessions or not. If they're not confessions, then the corpus delicti rule does not apply.
But she did say she left the child on the step outdoors on a cold night. And couldn't the state have argued that admission constituted proof that she was reckless?
Well, I think that's certainly what the state did argue, and I think if it's viewed in that light, that is a confessional statement, and the corpus delicti rule applies. Some of the other statements that she made, she talked to various people. She talked to her husband. She talked to the primary prosecution witness, this lady, Ms. Clark. She also talked to a couple of other, I think they were social service workers for the state, as well as Detective Fraley, who interviewed the accused.
Maybe you can help me draw the line between confession and admission. If, for example, someone admits to facts that generally people would view to be reckless or careless conduct, but they didn't confess to intending to commit a crime, is that a meaningful distinction for the purpose of the corpus delicti rule?
Probably not. I mean, I think that constitutes a confession in that instance. You may not realize you're confessing because your explanation is, well, I didn't intend that, but the crime itself only requires a reckless state of mind. And that's why it's a little confusing here, because it's not the state's not required to prove an intentional act. They're only required to prove recklessness for this particular charge.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So you're saying that
the state was able to demonstrate the child was left on the step by her through the statements of others. Therefore, the fact that she also made it in her own statement isn't really dispositive.
Well, I don't know if I can go that far, because I think the evidence that the state had stopped when Ms. Clark is dropped off at her parents' home in Bridgeville, Ms. Clark doesn't personally observe the child being dropped off in Georgetown that occurs after that. So I think for that part, the state did rely on the defendant's own admission or confession, however you characterize that. So I think that's a starting point, at least here. The trial judge assumed that it was a confession and went ahead and did the correct analysis.
What was your point of referencing, the social worker or the other person that the state presented testimony from? And you also referenced Ms. Bailey's husband. What did they introduce that was helpful to the state?
Well, I think they introduced the fact that she told her husband that she was, in fact, pregnant and that she had delivered a child. And then the question is, well, what did you do with the child? That's the further step. And I think that's when we're in the area of where the corpus delicti rule would have application, is what did she ultimately do with this child that was born? And you have to have a child that's born alive to have a homicide. So I think those statements certainly indicate that the child was born alive. Nonetheless, I think there was sufficient evidence presented by the state, independent of the mother's statement or statements, in order to establish the corpus delicti in this particular case. There was a child who was born alive on January 28th of 2003. There was fairly graphic eyewitness testimony from this lady, Joy Dawn Clark, who had worked with Julie Bailey as a waitress. She was actually there at Eric Grant's house when the child was born. Clark testified that she was actually able to see into the bathroom where the child was born because the door was open. She did see the child moving, and she heard the child crying, at least for a period of time. She sees the mother take the child out of the bathroom wrapped up in a green fuzzy bath mat. Clark also says she hears the crying for approximately about 15 minutes, but doesn't hear the crying after that period of time. The mother, according to Clark, puts the child wrapped in this bath mat in the back seat of the mother's car. Clark is then driven back to her parents' home in Bridgeville and is dropped off there about 5 in the morning, and that's the last that Clark knows in terms of her eyewitness testimony.
But is the state's theory of the case dependent on when the baby died?
No, I don't think so. The baby may have died in the car. It's difficult to say. The mother's testimony when she takes the stand is that the baby was alive when she left it on the doorstep at Mr. Clay's residence in Georgetown. But the state doesn't have any evidence one way or the other to refute or affirm that. That's the mother's testimony. The corpus delicti requires the state to show evidence prior to that. And I think
did the state have the state had evidence of a canvas of all of the houses in the neighborhood that no child was there.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Was there a similar canvas of hospitals that no infant was taken to the hospitals?
I don't think there was any testimony about that. The testimony, I believe, was in the spring of 2003, approximately 3 or 4 months after the child was born, that the state police went door to door in Mr. Clay's Georgetown neighborhood to see if there were any infants who had suddenly appeared, unknown infants, and nothing was found. There was some other evidence in the case in addition to Clark's testimony. There was some DNA blood evidence that was taken from the bathroom. A vinyl tile was removed from the floor. It was analyzed, and the analysis was that the DNA found in this blood spot was consistent with offspring of Julie Bailey and David Wingate, the individual who was the putative father of the child here. So there was that evidence in the case. There was also evidence about the weather conditions, that the high that particular day in Sussex County had been 33 degrees Fahrenheit and the low was 6 degrees Fahrenheit, and that became important when the doctor, David Paul, the neonatologist, I guess that's it, testified that children, newborns, are very susceptible to cold distress. You have to keep them warm, and that a child who was exposed to temperatures of 8 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, according to the doctor, for even a matter of minutes, would be in severe distress and perhaps would die. So
and
I think,
that, according to the state's evidence, that or theory of the prosecution, that exposure would be on the doorstep as opposed to anywhere else.
Yes, I think that's true. The other evidence was that the child was wrapped up in a bath mat even when the child was in the back seat of the car. I don't recall if there was any testimony about whether the heat was on the car or not, but I assume the heat probably would be as cold as it was that night. So I think given that evidence, there was sufficient independent proof of the corpus delicti in order to sustain the conviction here. And that's apart from the admissory or confessional statements of the accused in this particular instance.
Well, if the child had died in the back seat, what crime would the defendant have committed?
Well, I'm not sure if it would be in the first degree or not. It might be murder by abuse or neglect in the second degree, and having the child in this cold house where there was no running water, and then not making really any preparations for the birth of the child. I think the only person who said she really brought anything to the house that evening was Clark, who said she had grabbed a couple of towels from her parents' home and taken those with her. But there did not seem to be any other preparations by the mother. She had just made this frantic phone call, or actually had made a series of phone calls, and finally got through about 3 a.m. and reached Clark's parents and said she was coming to their Bridgeville house to pick up Clark. So I think it may not have been the same degree. There's a first degree and a second degree.
Was Clark
homicide.
Charged with anything?
No, I don't believe Clark was charged with anything, Your Honor.
Well, on the second issue, we're taking up a lot of your time on this first issue. Do you know of any cases where this statute was read into evidence the way it was done in this case?
No, and I haven't seen a lay witness read a statute into evidence before. I think it came about that way when the Detective Fraley was testifying, I believe, on rebuttal, and it was a request by the state for the court to charge the jury as to the provisions of the Safe Arms for Babies Act. It was a law that had been adopted in or become effective in 2001, and this all occurred in 2003, so the law was in effect. The trial judge's ruling was that if it was going to come in, it needed to come in the state's evidence. Otherwise, there wasn't going to be just an instruction given. And for that reason, I think the state went ahead and had the officer read, I believe it was subsections B and C of the Act.
What connects this statute to the defendant's state of mind?
Well, I think it certainly sets a standard of some sort. You have to determine recklessness, and recklessness is just a conscious disregard of a known duty or responsibility here. And what this does, or the purpose of the statute, is to allow someone to take an unwanted child and to drop it off at a hospital emergency room in the care of healthcare professionals. And then if you do that, it's like a safe harbor. You won't be charged criminally with a homicide if for some reason the child dies after
that. But
this
was introduced during the state's case in chief. Is that correct?
It may have been. I thought it was rebuttal, but it may have been the case in chief.
Either way, how does it relate to what the state has to prove? The state demonstrated that she left the child, according to her own admission, on the step in the cold. And as the defense points out in its brief, the fact that there were alternatives available, the defense argues, is irrelevant. You prove what she did, and what she did constitutes a crime, and other options that she could have pursued really aren't relevant.
Well, Well, I think it is relevant if there were other options that were certainly better than leaving a child on a doorstep. She doesn't say that anyone actually comes to the door. She says she sees the curtains rustle when she taps on the front bedroom window, and she hears a television set on. But her testimony is never that she sees someone open the door as she's walking away, or sees someone actually retrieve the child. Her testimony is simply that she left the child on the doorstep, and I think it's certainly material.
She also said, and I'd ask you, she said, and this is at H102, I took him to his father's because that at the time was the only thing that I knew what to do. Was that testimony accepted at trial by the state? In other words, was there any effort to challenge that?
Well, I guess there was some effort in that Detective Fraley testified to her statement, and in her statement she says, well, I'm a nurse and I know this looks bad. So I think in that respect it was being challenged that there were other alternatives. If you're a nurse, presumably you would know about the statute.
Somewhere I read in the record, and now I'm not sure I didn't make it up, but wasn't there some statement in the record to the effect that I didn't take the baby to the hospital because they would have known me if I went there?
Yes, that's her explanation. That presumably she knew, you know.
She was conscious that that was an alternative.
Well, I would think so. Otherwise, why would you get into that subject? I mean, you know, why would you even discuss taking the child to the hospital if that didn't even occur to you? I think the jury could infer
she was more concerned about her reputation than she was about the welfare of the child.
Well, her reputation, or as pointed out already in oral argument, perhaps being charged with some other criminal offense, neglect of a child, for example, or something like that. but it does seem, that there was some consciousness about the fact that the child could have been left at the hospital. She just says that, well, I couldn't do it because I used to work at the med-surg unit there, and the people know me. This hospital.
Is this part of her statement to the police, or is this part of her testimony at trial?
part of it is in the statement to Detective Fraley. That's where she says, I'm a nurse and I know this looks bad. The rest of it, I think, came in through trial evidence, and I'm not sure if it was all the defense statement or if there was some evidence by the state that was presented. There was some evidence about her taking nursing courses at Del Tech. There was an individual that had testified about that she wasn't actually an RN, although she had worked at the hospital for a little over a year before this all occurred. So I think there was some evidence. I'm just not sure if it was in the state's case or the defense case or some was in each part. But that was presented for the jury's consideration here. The trial judge ultimately decided to take judicial notice of the statute under Delaware Rule of Evidence 202A1, and he allowed the police officer, actually said that the state had to introduce it in its case, so the police officer then read two portions of the statute. I don't believe there was any additional instruction by the court. I don't recall seeing any.
And what was the basis for admitting this evidence?
Well, the challenge to not admitting it was that it was irrelevant, and then there was an additional challenge under 403 that it would be confusing to a lay jury to hear this. And the state's argument, I guess, was that it went to the required state of mind. The state was required to prove that is reckless action by the accused, and that's why they were admitting it, to show that her conduct was reckless in not dropping the child off at a hospital.
For whatever it's worth at this point, my notes say that in your answering brief at page 17 and 18, it's noted that Fraley wrote during the time of taking the defendant's statement, she's not saying that I know there was a law that says I could have dropped it off at the hospital. She is asked why she didn't, and she said it's because she worked there and they would have known her. That at least suggests to me that it didn't come from her trial testimony, but it came from the statement she gave to the police, at least his interpretation of what she said.
I think that's probably true. I don't know if it was reiterated in the defendant's trial testimony or not. I just don't recall at this point.
So one way to construe that as she didn't know about it, but even if she did know about it, she would not have exercised that option.
Yes, I think that's true. It certainly goes at least that far, and it may go farther. And there is a common law presumption about knowing the law of your jurisdiction. There's some old cases. I didn't find any in Delaware, but in other jurisdictions. There's actually one fairly recent Maryland case. I believe it's a civil case in 96.
Could the state have called witnesses, hypothetically, to say that her mother lived two blocks away, her siblings lived 90 feet away, and basically presented witnesses to say she had one, two, three choices, one's enough, of somebody that was right there and could have taken the child to demonstrate her recklessness?
Well, I suppose they could have done that. This all occurred about a mile or a mile and a half from her home. I mean, she could have just taken the child home instead of, you know, driving around Sussex County at night with the child.
She could have driven the child to the hospital and let Clark take her in. Child into the hospital.
Well, that's true too. I mean, that was certainly an alternative, but before dropping Clark off in Bridgeville, she was only about a mile and a half from the Nanticoke Hospital. All this occurred in Seaford, and Clark's parents lived in Bridgeville. Before going back to Bridgeville, she could have just had Clark take the child in. That was an alternative too. I don't think anybody argued that, but that's certainly reasonable. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
All right, thank you.
I'd like to address several points in rebuttal, if the court permits. The state first made the point that the corpus delicti rule may not apply because this was really not a confession. This is to a crime. We submit that that's really not pertinent. Most of the although confessions may be part of the issue of the corpus delicti, it's not necessary that a confession to be made to a police officer in order to raise a corpus delicti issue, and that dates from all the common law cases up until the present day. The court raised an interesting point with the state. The court raised the point as to whether the evidence would support an inference that the baby may have died in the car. And the state admitted that, that under this evidence the baby may have died in the car. If that in fact occurred, however, does that establish recklessness beyond reasonable doubt, such as to convict her of murder by abuse or neglect in the first degree? That's really a question, right? Right there as to sufficiency of the evidence under Jackson versus Virginia.
Why in 2006, given the alternatives of a hospital, wouldn't it?
Well, under those circumstances, the jury says has to consider it, and this jury was tainted by the instruction concerning the Safe Arms for Babies law. And secondly, it would provoke a situation whereby every teenager or anyone else who gave birth to a baby at home or under a potentially perilous situation, not the protective medical environment of a hospital, if there was an untoward consequence, that person would be responsible for murder by abuse or neglect in the first degree.
Absolutely, and they'd be measured by a jury on the basis of the extent to which they individually, in that given context, perceived and disregarded a known risk.
Correct.
That's what recklessness is all about.
Correct, it is. But the recklessness here...
You're suggesting there's something troublesome about that. I'm not getting what's troublesome about
it. Well, what's troublesome about it is also the state in this case had the benefit of its instruction that the Safe Arms for Babies law was not just availed of.
Well, I admit that's a wrinkle that we've all got to sort through. But apart from that, what's troublesome about no matter what the circumstances are, you have a baby and you're conscious that there's a hospital nearby and you don't take that helpless infant to the hospital for care? Why isn't that reckless conduct given virtually any scenario?
It may be reckless conduct depending upon the facts and circumstances, but it doesn't establish it per se.
Well, I agree it doesn't establish it per se, but the jury's going to decide that in the context given the nature of the individual and all the circumstances.
The state also claims that the statute sets a standard here, and that's the problem with that instruction. The statute, the reading of the Safe Arms for Babies law, set a standard of recklessness per se, and that is the problem with that instruction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel will take the case under advisement and recess.